Welcome to Ranch Radio, the official broadcast of the Spread Eagle Ranch and Need More Land and Cattle Company. My name is Mugtoe, and I haven't yet settled upon a liturgy for this service, but I'm a spiritual healer with a prehensile feeler that'll get up in your business like a baby's arm swigging a peach. So I'll start this maiden voyage with some of what is readily at hand, and perhaps I'll be caught up in the spirit and do some of the Lord's work as well. I've got drug-fueled stories of sexual misadventures and odes of riverside redemption and canine companionship. So whenever I manage to wrap this up and Sister Beverly sits down at the piano to begin playing Just As I Am, perhaps we'll have a decent altar call, beloved. Don't talk about the Mugtoe connection. This is just the merest sampling of the evil E designed to convict the great unwashed of their sinful nature while offering up a peek into the broad sunlit uplands of my world. Greetings, brothers and sisters, and fellow travelers everywhere. This is Ranch Radio.
Mucker Dan resides in Dallas, grinding his teeth and dumpster diving, never resting from contriving ways to ornament a palace. Old coffee cup, to him a chalice. Other junk he will enliven, and endlessly chattering he'll be driving me to distraction, enhancing my malice. Bug-eyed grin and snaggle tooth with a weakness in his chin, and what would be a winning grin on any other face, in truth, with Dan remains wholly uncouth. Christian charity he won't win, his base metal turns to tin. Bad speed, the fountain of his youth. Beware the face of Mucker Dan, hold no truck with this son of man.
Sweet William. How about little Sweet William? He started out so seemingly together and ended up being taken away in an ambulance. The whole affair left me scratching my head a bit. At first, I thought he was rather charming. He was a waiter, and it was nice of him to bring all those credit card numbers over and order all that Chinese food delivery, even though I wasn't a bit hungry most of the time. He gave the best head of anyone I'd ever been with, bar none, even if he wasn't the greatest piece of ass I'd ever had. Besides, he was Brian's ex, and I thought it was fitting at the time. Brian was a former roommate and running buddy who had left on me money and trash in the back bedroom where he had stayed with his trick du jour for 2 or 3 months. I don't know how many days we stayed up, but it was far from a record. 7, I think. But they were the concentrated days of amphetamine use. We'd shoot coke and speed mix to improve the rush of the crystal and stretch the wire of the coke out a bit to avoid some of that hateful Jones feeling. William would get on the phone and dial one of those sex lines and invite guys over to my house. I wasn't particularly interested in messing around with a stranger, but I didn't object to William screwing everybody in town. The sight of him getting sport fucked in my living room and the memory of my late grandfather sitting in the recliner a few feet away was a strange juxtaposition of images for me. My ex-boyfriend, Rick, showed up one evening, and he and William hit it off pretty well. They ran more guys through that house in one night than even I thought appropriate. I just kept doing dope and drinking and talking with a friend of mine with whom I had grown up while the two of them gave of themselves energetically by firelight just a few feet away. Rick was beautiful, but he was dumb as a post and about half a bubble off level. I felt a certain proprietary responsibility for him that I didn't entertain towards William, so I called him away before the night was over and told him to cleave under my bosom for the remainder of his stay. This left William a bit nonplussed, but he seemed to cope with it admirably. This was near the end of our little run. Towards mid-morning, we were visited by some friends who had some time to kill while they waited to score. I had finished off the dope during the previous night's debauch, and my guests made a thorough inspection of the house to verify that I wasn't lying. I was happy to let them do so. Brian had been such an inveterate schitzer that I was never surprised to find a 16th of coke hidden in the paneling or under the carpet somewhere in the house. My visitors were Nairobi and some ex-con acquaintance of hers. Nairobi was a black drag queen who was known for her acrobatic performances on bars and pool tables and her willingness to drive 30 miles to score a $20 bag to split between 5 people. I enjoyed her company at clubs, but she was not the first person I wanted to see at 10 in the morning when we already felt like hammered shit and she looked to be in similar condition. However, she always managed a genuine smile and called me Frankie Tank with a spasm of her entire body and much jiggling. William had been acting withdrawn ever since the sun had come up. Late the previous night, Brian had shown up and given us some GHB. I had never taken it before and was unimpressed. After so much time awake, regularly injecting 50 units of coke and crank so thick it looked like honey and knocked my knees out from under me in a drooling seizure, the little vials of GHB had the effect of a cheap caffeine wire on me. William, however, seemed to be feeling something entirely different. I had been doing a great deal more dope than he did for the previous week, partly because I have a greater tolerance and weigh quite a bit more, but also because I was buying and didn't feel like playing host organism to anybody, no matter how talented they were at fellatio. Things had gotten quiet around the house, and I suddenly noticed that William was nowhere to be seen. I went back to my bedroom and found him cowering between my bed and the wall just under my open window. "What's wrong, baby?" I asked. He only muttered, but he looked terrified. I got that feeling of impending drama that I really hate when I've been traveling the chemical path for some days. I hated what was happening. I sat up across the bed from him and turned away for a moment to think. I was going to have to talk him through this and minimize it, or I'd be babysitting his ass all day long. I turned back around just in time to see him disappear through the window. He was shaking his head and muttering, "I can't. I just can't stay in there." And then he was gone. I ran to the window and poked my head through. No William. I ran back through the house into the front door. I looked up and down the street from my porch and finally caught sight of him several houses down in my neighbor's driveway. He was talking on their cordless phone while they worked on their truck. He looked like one of the undead standing next to those two rednecks with the flag of Dixie proudly displayed from their living room window. I shuddered. I walked calmly but quickly towards William. He finished his call and just stood there shaking his head at me. I pulled him out of earshot of the guys under the truck. I knew them both from high school, but I didn't think they needed to be privy to this current disaster of mine. "William, you've got to come back to the house right now." "I can't. I'm so sorry." I was confused, but I tried to be sympathetic. "What's wrong, babe? I just don't want you to get into trouble out here." He had a pleading look in his eyes. It was apparently... I was apparently oblivious to some danger that he saw very clearly. "There's something bad in there, Mugtoe. You think I don't know there's a drag queen and an ex-con in my house that would trade your mama for dope? Pumpkin, now come on with me and let's go back inside, please." I thought I made some headway. I felt a sense of impending denouement to the whole affair. I turned to lead him back to the house and almost walked right into a cop. I then realized that there was also an ambulance, a fire truck, two cop cars, and people on every porch in sight. Great. Fucking great. He had apparently been making a 911 call from the neighbor's cordless. I saw Nairobi and her cohort driving past us with Rick in the back seat looking out the window with that blank stare of a child being abducted into the circus that he always had under any circumstance. William was quickly attended to, then hauled off in the ambulance. This left the local constabulary with nobody to talk to except myself. Great! They escorted me back to my house. I invited them in. Why not? If there had been anything worth finding, Nairobi would have sniffed it out long before they ever could. I had a nice pattern of tracks on my arms, but I was wearing long sleeves. I'd been up for about 6 or 7 days, but I was fairly lucid and articulate. The presence of law enforcement in any capacity always seems to have that effect on me. I couldn't have helped them if I'd wanted to. I never bought anything out there in the burbs anyway. Still, I have always found that it doesn't do to get into a pissing contest with a cop if I can help it, and it's always best to appear stupid. I don't need to count coup on them. They looked about, found nothing worth hauling me in for. They took my papers and some calcified rigs and split after making threatening statements for about 15 minutes, leaving me alone in the house. I did the dishes, got religion yet one more time, and stayed clean for almost a year thereafter. Well, okay, maybe 6 months. It was that long as well before I saw William again. He showed up one night very late, pounding on my bedroom window and tripping on E. He burst in when I opened the front door and gave me a pretty memorable blowjob, but I didn't let him hitch his cart to my horse again.
Jamie was too young to hate. He was only 8 years old. As he sat on the worn porch of the unpainted farmhouse and watched the wagon creak down the dusty lane, he hurt deeply. But he did not hate. He didn't even hate Rupert. He kept his eyes glued to the wagon as it rattled between the walls of jimson weed which lined the rutted lane. There was his Grandpa Wilson sitting ramrod straight on the spring seat. His galluses made a distinct cross on his back, and the dust was already beginning to turn his black Sunday felt hat into a furry, dusty brown thing. Jamie could not see his face, but knew that if he could, he would see a stubby pipe strongly clenched between his teeth. The pipe was always there. It didn't seem to make much difference to Grandpa Wilson whether it had tobacco in it or not. Jamie never just called him Grandpa, but was careful to always call him Grandpa Wilson to remind himself that he was not a Wilson. He was Jamie Balfour. Jamie was not afraid of him anymore, not even when he had to look into the cold gray eyes above the full mustache and knew he was going to get a licking with the harness strap which hung behind the kitchen door. Beside Grandpa Wilson on the spring seat was the squat gray figure of his grandmother, which he could only see through the dust when the weeds along the road were thin or short. As he watched through the stationary haze of dust, Jamie realized that he never called his grandmother anything. She was referred to by Grandpa Wilson as your grandmother, or by Rupert as my mother, with a lot of stress on the first word. She always looked at him with sad and almost tearful eyes that seemed to say there was little, if any, hope for either of them. Jamie's grandmother never used the harness strap. She preferred instead to recite Jamie's endless faults in detail to Grandpa Wilson, who would then remove the strap from the nail in the wall behind the kitchen door and silently punish the offender. Worse even than the beatings or the recountings of his sins were the things she said about him. They drummed inside him as he watched the wagon. It's easy to see the Balfour in him. He'll probably die drunk. If only our Nora hadn't been blinded by the devil, maybe she wouldn't have married Frank Balfour. Now she's dead and gone, and him buried beside her. There's no hope for the boy, Fred. I can see Frank Balfour all over him. Rupert says he broke a limb climbing in the biggest peach tree this morning. It had been his grandmother who had told him how his parents had died. Jamie had remembered the fire, of course. It was only a year and a half ago. He remembered waking in his bed, choking on smoke, too dazed and hurt to scream. He remembered his father groping through the strange glow with a cloth over his face. He remembered the feel of his father's hands picking him up and carrying him to the window. There was one moment of hesitation before his father kicked the glass out of the window and threw the boy into the muddy garden below. All that he remembered. His grandmother told him never to tell such fancy tales again, that Frank Balfour had died drunk in bed, as everyone in the county with any sense had known he would, and that he had taken her daughter with him. Jamie never told the story again, but he remembered. The wagon had grown much smaller down the lane, and he could no longer hear the harness clink or the rattle of the wheels, but he could still make out the dim figure of Rupert sitting in the back of the wagon, watching him. Rupert was 14. He was the youngest of Fred and Ruby Wilson's 7 children, and the only one left at home with them. It was Rupert for whom his grandmother made apple pies. She didn't do it often, though, for sugar was dear. It was Rupert who had a feather bed while Jamie slept on a mattress filled with corn shucks. It was Rupert who went to school every day while Jamie just went when he could be spared from work. Best of all, Rupert had a bicycle. Jamie's toes plowed small furrows in the soft dust beneath where he sat on the porch as he swung his legs to and fro. It was Saturday morning and hot all around already, despite the early hour. Saturdays had become his favorite time. On Saturdays, his grandparents would hitch the mules to the wagon and go to Lancaster, 6 miles away. They would not be back till nearly sundown. Until then, he could be alone. The first Saturday after he came to the farm, he also had climbed on the wagon. They said nothing, just looked at him with disapproval until he climbed down off the wagon with tears running down his cheeks and sat on the porch. Then they drove away without a backward glance. Jamie had cried then for a long time. In only a week, he had learned that he was not wanted. It was another month before he refused to cry about that or anything else. Jamie learned to avoid most of the lickings. He learned the limits and learned to stay in them. He avoided Rupert and his extensive possessions at all costs. While he could not talk to his grandparents and had learned to expect no warmth from either of them, he could at least avoid their anger most of the time. When he did trespass, either knowingly or by error, he took his licking dry-eyed and in silence. He had resolved that no Wilson would ever see him cry again. He saw the wagon had reached the end of the long lane and was turning into the road that led to the ford on 10 Mile Creek. He knew that as soon as the wagon turned, he would be hidden from its occupants, not only by the high weeds, but also by the descent of the road to the creek. The wagon disappeared from view, and Jamie jumped off the porch and ran across the dusty yard to the smokehouse. Beside the shack-like structure of the smokehouse, which housed the Wilson's smoked meats and sausage, was a great round oak stump with an anvil mounted on its flat surface. Leaning against this stump was Rupert's bicycle. It was fastened to the stump with a rather long piece of heavy rope and tied to the anvil with a complex knot. Rupert's bicycle was a thing of awesome beauty. It was red and gold. Jamie, of course, was forbidden to touch it. It belonged to Rupert. He had ridden it the first week that he had been left alone on Saturday and had been given a beating for it, but it had been worth it. Now, Rupert always inspected the bicycle as soon as he returned from town to see if it had been disturbed. Jamie now approached the problem of the bicycle with professional care. He took a stick and marked the exact location of each tire and studied exactly where the bicycle leaned against the stump. Using a nail he had found, he made a tiny scratch on the stump just where the bar of the bicycle leaned against it. Rupert must have been in a hurry this morning. The bicycle tying would be simple to duplicate. He rode the bicycle all around the yard and even down the lane almost to the road. In the few places where the lane was smooth, he could even ride for a short distance without holding the handlebars. Jamie might have ridden longer had he not heard a faint sound of music which promised more excitement than even the fabulous bicycle. He was even more sure when he saw a thin wisp of smoke coming from the creek bottom. The gypsies! He had heard Grandpa Wilson tell his grandmother of them the night before. They were camped on Stovall land, which adjoined the Wilson farm at the creek. Grandpa Wilson remarked that George Stovall never did have much sense and must have lost what he had to let gypsies camp on his land. "There won't be a frying chicken or a roasting shoat that's safe around here till they move out. They're not Christian, Ruby. I won't have them around my farm. I'll see Stovall in town tomorrow and tell him he has to move them out." Jamie knew that he had to see the gypsies, but first he had to erase all trace of his having used the bicycle and tie it back to the stump. This took nearly an hour, including the removal of all the tire tracks. At last he was free to go. The music had stopped, or at least he couldn't hear it anymore as he ran across the cotton field toward the distant line of trees. The thin column of smoke was gone too, but he remembered where he had seen it. Jamie was careful to run down the furrows so that he wouldn't disturb the cotton plants. Clouds of small insects and some large grasshoppers rose before him as he ran, marking his progress through the field. He was breathless when he reached the three-stranded barbed wire fence which separated the Wilson farm from their neighbors, the Stovalls. He paused there a moment to try to get his breathing slowed down. He was less than 50 yards from where the creek bed. The woods along the creek had always seemed a little ominous and seemed no less so because he could hear an occasional shout from the gypsy camp. 10 Mile Creek cut sharply into the chalky white limestone which underlay the black cotton land as it made this bend. Jamie knew from where he had seen the smoke and by where the shouts were coming that the gypsies were camped on the big gravel bar at the inside bend of the creek. He decided that he would creep up through the trees and brush and vines until he could peek through the bushes right on the edge of the bluff and see the gypsy camp without being detected. On this side, he knew that the creek bank dropped steeply off for about 15 feet to the water and that trees and vines grew to the very edge of the drop. The sounds of the gypsy camp came plainly to Jamie as he forced his way through the tangle of vines, not until he had reached the very edge of the little limestone cliff and slowly parted the last bushes could he see the camp. It was there before him in the shady little meadow across the creek. There were four wagons, such as Jamie had never seen before. They were mostly white, but were trimmed in red and gold bands and swirls. Except for the hearse at Redford, Jamie didn't remember ever seeing a painted wagon before. These wagons looked a little like the hearse, but with the decorated cabin on their beds, they looked taller and bigger, and they were painted so gaily. The gypsies were there too. Jamie didn't actually count them, but there must have been close to 20 there. They were dark, like Mexicans, some even darker. They didn't dress like people Jamie knew either. The women were slim-waisted and wore great swinging skirts with brightly colored trim. They walked free-striding like a man, and they laughed and talked like men. What caught Jamie's eye most was the jewelry. Every arm wore a load of gold or silver bracelets, and many of the women wore rings. One boy about Jamie's age wore a gold earring. After careful study, Jamie came to the conclusion that the ear had a hole punched through it, and he winced at the thought. It was obvious that the gypsies were breaking camp. Some of them were busy packing things away in the bright wagons. It happened so quickly that Jamie could not tell how he fell into the creek. Perhaps he leaned too far out to see better. There was a sharp snap that may have been a rock falling or a branch breaking, and then he was falling through the air with shreds of vines and briars on his clothes. Even though he fell into the water, it was not deep enough to cushion his fall very much. It was almost like falling on a table. It was not until the man came splashing through the water and scooped him up that Jamie knew the gypsies had seen him fall. The man was big and strong and dark. He had a great black mustache and coal black hair tied at the nape of his neck into a short ponytail. His arms were bare, and he wore a wide black leather belt with a huge silver buckle. The man tossed him in the air and caught him again as he fell toward the creek. "Oh, Nagreb has caught a fish! Make ready the pot! Nagreb has caught a fish!" Jamie felt icy fear. Could it be true? Grandpa Wilson had said that the gypsies were not Christian, and he was being carried away toward the campfire, which was still burning in a water-worn pothole on a great flat rock across the creek. As Nagreb splashed through the creek and onto the rock, Jamie felt sure that he would be cast into the glowing coals that came ever nearer. Nagreb set him down against an elm log, which had been toppled by last spring's floods, and stepped back a pace to look at him. Jamie wondered if perhaps there were gypsy rites or ceremonies that had to be said. The gypsies had gathered about him in a loose circle. Escape was impossible. They were talking amongst themselves in a language Jamie could not understand. Some of them were smiling and laughing, too, but Jamie put no great stock of hope in it. He permitted his eyes to move enough to see if any of them were preparing a pot. Nagreb squatted down until the space was near Jamie's and raised his hand. The talking ceased. "What is your name, boy?" Nagreb roared. To Jamie, his voice sounded like the sound of a hammer on an anvil. Jamie willed his voice to answer, but no sound came from his throat. He might have struggled to answer again, but just then the dog came. The dog was maybe 10 weeks old. It was an indeterminate breed, and at that big-footed, tail-wagging, awkward stage common to most large dog breed. It burst from the ring of silent gypsies and bound across the white rock into Jamie's lap, all energy and joy. Its outsized tail thumped happily against his wet cotton pants, and it licked his face, mouth, and his eyes. The dog was happiness, friendship, and allegiance. Then Jamie realized that Nagreb had retreated, and his place before Jamie had been taken by an old woman. Her voice was thick with accent, but there was no doubt about the kindness in it. "Do not be afraid. That Nagreb is a fool. He will not hurt you. Nagreb, he made a bad joke. You're not a fish. You good boy, you big boy. Here now, you no cry. You, Nagreb, get this boy cup milk. Hey, boy, this dog, he like you. How is your name?" Jamie found that he could answer. James Harris Balfour? "You good boy. We gypsies, you know. We live here 4 day. Fix wagons, graze horses. We leave today. Soon, you good boy. Where you live?" James managed, despite the wriggling puppy, to point up toward the Wilson farmhouse. "So you live there? You good boy, James. Sure you hungry? All boys hungry all time. Here you have a bowl of good stew. Good stew, 3 squirrel, 2 rabbit maybe. Very good stew. Here all you go away. Here you play music." Jamie suddenly knew that he wasn't going to be eaten. It had been all a bad dream. The dog was curled up against him. The woman had brought him a metal plate heaped with stew and a cold stone mug of good but very strange milk. Jamie had never tasted goat's milk. The circle of gypsies had drifted away at the old lady's command and busied themselves with packing their wagons and harnessing the horses and oxen that pulled them. A few goats and one big cow were halted to lead ropes tied to the wagons. Two boys about Jamie's age to watch him without expression while he ate. The dog pressed against his side as he ate, thumping the rock with his tail when Jamie looked down at him. Jamie thought it was the prettiest dog he'd ever seen. When the old lady came to get the cup and plate, Jamie saw that the gypsies were ready to leave. All of them except McGreb and one other man had mounted the wagons, and all were obviously waiting for the old lady to come join them. "Hey, James, you eat good. See you all gone. Why you say you're not hungry?" "It was good," Jamie dodged the question. "Sure good. Good gypsy stew." "Good squirrel." "Hey, James, you got dog?" James looked down at the dog beside him and shook his head. "How you like this black dog?" "He's a beautiful dog, ma'am. And he's a smart dog, too." "Okay, he's your dog now. You take good care of this dog. He is your dog. We go now. Very late. Far to go. Goodbye, James." The old woman climbed the wheel of the lead wagon onto the high front seat. Jamie watched as the wagons groaned up the sharp rise out of the creek and almost instantly disappeared in the surrounding woodlands. He placed a restraining hand on the puppy to keep it from following the wagons, but he did not try to follow them. The dog seemed happy to lie beside him in the sun. As Jamie ran back across the cotton field toward the Wilson farmhouse, he was happier than ever before. Gone were all the hurts. He had a friend. The dog gambolled and jumped excitedly at his heels as he ran. Once in a burst of speed, the dog tripped over his own great paws and rolled happily in the soft black earth between the rows of cotton. Jamie laughed and stopped to rub the soft fur between the dog's ears. As he reached the yard, he realized he had not asked the dog's name. He dropped to his knees and kept the dog's face in his hands. "I'll call you Gypsy. The gypsies gave you to me, and I will name you after them. Gypsy, you learn that name. You are my friend, and I'll take care of you and feed you. We can be together all the time, and I'll have someone with me when everyone goes away on Saturdays." He hugged the dog to him. The Wilsons came home earlier than usual that Saturday. As the wagon turned into the lane from the road, Jamie glanced around to be sure that he had not missed any bicycle tracks. As the wagon neared the yard, he was sitting on the porch as if he had not moved since the wagon left. Gypsy lay beside him with his chin resting on Jamie's leg. Grandpa Wilson stopped the team in the yard and strode directly to Jamie.
"Where'd you get that dog?"
"The gypsies gave him to me, sir." Jamie instantly knew that he should have lied. The old man's face was set and hard.
"You've been having truck with them gypsies, boy? They're heathens and thieves. I talked to George Stovall this morning. He's going to throw them off that land."
"They're gone, sir. They left about noon."
"Probably took half my chickens off with them while you were all down there at their camp. Rupert, you go look at the chickens."
Rupert made no move to go as he helped his mother down off the wagon seat. He stared at the dog, fascinated. Grandma Wilson made her way over to Jamie and stood before him with her hands on her hips.
"Gypsies, indeed. Look at you, your clothes all muddy. And it'll take a dear amount of soap to get them clean. Soap making's 2 months off, anyhow. Gypsies, just like your father. It's coming out in you, too. He always flirted with the devil. Some say he spoke French, too. You'll come to no good end, James Harris. Frank Balfour's sins are being visited upon his son, and will be visited on his son's son, even to the third generation. It says in the book, James Harris, you will not escape it. Do you hear me?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, you just remember it. I'll not have that dog in my house nor eating my cooking. It's a heathen dog. Do you hear me?"
"Yes, sir. I'll feed him out of my food. Outside, of course."
"Your food? Where are you getting any food, James Harris? You don't have anything you didn't come into this world with. It's only through the goodness of me and your grandpa that you ever put a bite in your mouth, and you remember it."
"Yes, sir." James' grandmother stomped scowling into the house to see if she could find a trace of the dog having already been there. Fred Wilson and Rupert returned from the chicken house and the barn where they had surveyed the livestock. Rupert ran up and addressed Jamie. Rupert said, "Pa says we can take the shotgun and take him down to the woods to see if he'll make a good hunter. He'll be more apt to let you keep him if he looks like he might make a hunter."
"Oh, he will, Rupert. You'll see. The old gypsy woman said he would make a great hunter."
Rupert vanished into the house, and he returned with Fred Wilson's long, double-barreled shotgun and 3 shells. He broke the shotgun, put a shell in each chamber, put the 3rd shell in his pocket. He left the shotgun broken and strode off toward the creek.
Jamie and Gypsy followed. About halfway across the cotton field, Rupert stopped and said to Jamie, "You go on ahead. You and the dog, you know the best places. I'll stay back so as not to make quite as much noise."
Jamie pushed past his uncle and strode on towards the Stovall's fence. He thought Gypsy was really too young for a hunter, but he just had to hunt. He had to prove to Wilson that Gypsy was a good dog. Gypsy was chasing grasshoppers two rows over, and Jamie wondered about the Bible and if Gypsy really was heathen, and what did heathen really mean? He heard the shotgun snap closed and suddenly knew what was happening before he ever heard the roar of the old gun. Jamie screamed in concert with the blast. Rupert had shot the dog when it was about 10 feet from Jamie, where it had stopped to try to find a lizard that had darted out of the cotton stalk forest. Like any farm boy, Jamie had seen death before, and when he dropped and gathered the limp body of the puppy into his arms, he knew the dog was dead already. He'd never made a sound. He was on his knees with the dog clutched to him when he looked up to see Rupert. Rupert stood with his feet apart and the shotgun held across his body, silhouetted against the cloudless sky. He grinned.
"Pa said I could shoot him. He ain't got no right here."
It was only after Rupert turned back toward the house that Jamie cried. He sat cross-legged between the cotton rows and hugged the dead dog, oblivious of the blood that streaked his clothes, his face, even his hair. It might have been an hour or even only a half an hour that Jamie sat there before he moved. The tears had stopped, but still he cried. As he walked, he carried the dog clutched to his chest. Jamie didn't know where he was going, he just walked. He walked away from the house, away from Rupert and the gun, away from his grandmother, away from the Bible and his father's sins. He crossed the creek and up the road the gypsies had taken that morning. He walked slowly as people do when they're not going anywhere. There's no way to know where Jamie might have gone or what he might have done if he had not met Nate Stone. Really, Jamie didn't meet Nate as much as Nate met Jamie. Nate was stopped by the road just a few yards beyond the ford of the creek. The wagon that he had bought just that morning was already showing the wisdom of its sale and the folly of its purchase. The tongue pin that had worked loose in the 5-mile trip, and Nate had spent an hour fixing it. He was a big man with huge arms and shoulders that a lifetime of blacksmithing will give to a man. He dripped sweat in big splatters on the inch-thick carpet of loose dust on the road, and he turned to see the boy walking upslope from the creek toward him. Jamie did not see Nate Stone nor hear the swish of the horses' tails as they tried to discourage the flies. He was not even aware of Nate's presence until an iron grip descended on his shoulders and he found himself face to face with the big, red-faced, dripping blacksmith.
"I say, boy, I'll be talking to you. What ails you?"
Jamie did not answer but stared at the smith in terror and clutched the dead gypsy to his chest.
"You do look a sight, boy. You got blood on you from head to foot. What ain't covered with blood is covered with dirt. Yes, sirree, boy, you do look like you got problems. Come on over here in the shade and let's see what can be done about this. Whose boy you be?"
Jamie found that he could talk.
"I'm James Harris Balfour."
Nate's brow wrinkled up as he pondered this information.
"And most likely you'd be Frank and Nora Balfour's boy. I don't know of no others by that name in these parts. Frank was from Tennessee and had no other people in his country. And I guess that you'd be coming from Fred Wilson's farm about now, him being Nora's pa. I knew your pa real well, son. He was one of the finest men I ever knew."
Jimmy's head jerked up as he looked at the blacksmith.
"You knew my father? Was he a sinner?"
Nate frowned.
"I expect he was, son. I guess all men are. What is it the book says? We all sin and fall short of the glory of God?
Something like that, anyway. He sinned no more than any other man, son, and there's only many an orphan and widow in this county that ate his bread. I'd be debtor to him for sure. Now let me take that dog for a minute, son. I got a gunny sack here in the wagon that can be used to shroud him, and there's a mattock in the wagon that we can use to dig him a grave, ground being soft here. Some people don't hold with sad words over animals, but I never saw no harm in it. Sure, and God's got enough mercy to go around. And if he don't, the words we say over people ain't going to do much good anyhow."
Nate had spoken softly and had gently taken the dog from Jamie's arms and had wrapped it
with great care in the big sack from under the wagon seat. Nate then dug an adequate grave with very few strokes of the mattock and laid the bundle in the bottom of the grave. He looked at Jamie sitting under the tree with his head in his hands. "Stand up, Jamie. It ain't fitting to say words when you're sitting down." Nate waited for Jamie to stand and bow his head, then continued, "Lord, this here grave holds James Balfour's dog. From the look of him, he was a good dog, and I think he was killed by a shotgun. We all know you work in mysterious ways, Lord, and it ain't up to us to understand. But, Lord, it is hard on a boy to lose his dog, and we're hoping you'll give James the strength to accept this work of thy hand. And, Lord, we ain't too sure what happens to critters, but dogs are somewhat different from other critters, and we're hoping you'll find a place up there for this one." Nate raised his hand, and Jamie knew the ceremony was over. "I didn't rightly know what to say, son, seeing as how I never said words for a dog before, and how as I never really knew this dog. You never told me his name, but that's all right. I said he was your dog. Now let's walk down there to the creek, and you take off your clothes you got on and wash the blood and dirt off of you, and tell me what happened to you. You do look a sight." Jamie had never found it easy to talk. This man who prayed for his dog, who knew his father, and said good things about him, seemed to pull 2 years of pent-up misery out of Jamie. He talked about the fire, about the lickings, about his grandmother's predictions, about Rupert, and about Rupert's bicycle. The Smith's brow furrowed ever deeper as Jamie talked. After Jamie had dressed again, they walked hand in hand back to the wagon. Then Nate said, "Jamie, I want to go talk to your grandpa. Now don't fret about this. This here's a nervous team, and I can't leave it alone, so I want you to sit with them until I come back. Now don't go off, because this team would bolt for sure, and I'd be out of a brace of horses and a no-good wagon I got beat on today. I'll be back shortly." Before Jamie could protest, Nate had turned and was walking briskly toward the Wilson house. It seemed like a long time before Nate came back. Jamie had time to think about all that had happened that morning. He'd been too young to hate. It was different now. Rupert had changed all that in the cotton field. It wasn't just hurt now. He'd grown used to being hurt. It was a new emotion that filled him as he pictured Rupert standing above him with the black shotgun outlined against the sky. And Rupert had said, "Pa said I could shoot him." He could never forget that, and all those things his grandmother had said about his father. The man who owned this wagon didn't believe them. So why did Jamie have to believe them now? Jamie didn't know what to do, but he knew he could never go back to the Wilson farm. He was still thinking of these things when Nate Stone came walking up the road. The blacksmith was red-faced and hot. "I tell you, Jamie, this place is not fit for man nor beast in August." "No, sir." "Well, Jamie, here's what happened. I went to see your grandpa. I won't say we see eye to eye, but your grandpa and me, fact is we differed considerable. But just to show you that you can do business with people you don't agree with, we came to some agreements. Of course, all this depends on you, Jamie, on what you want to do." He paused to mop his head, then went on. "Your grandpa was some ired at you. Before it was over, I was some ired at him. As soon as he found out I was a friend of Frank Balfour, he was even more ired at me. So I guess we was all mad. Now, when people get mad, they seldom come to agreements, so I consider it passing strange that we did. He first of all wanted you to come straight back right then. He said you were due a licking and he was going to see that you got it. Now, I ain't against boys getting a licking when it's due, and there was never a boy who didn't need one sometime. But what with Rupert chiming in frequent about what all bad you did and how his pa said he could shoot your dog, and what with your grandma saying this is all Frank Balfour's fault, I just plain got ired. Now, Jamie, here's the part you need to listen close. I be a blacksmith with my forge in Red Elm on yonder side of the county. Good 4-hour wagon ride from here. I need apprentice real bad. Now don't answer straight off, let me tell you about it. While I was talking to your grandpa and Rupert putting in and Ruby Wilson saying Frank killed her daughter, it came to me in a flash that you might want to come be my apprentice blacksmith. Now I know you're only 8 and that you'd have to feed out at my house for a few years before you could work in the shop, and seeing as how you'd need to reckon pay and things like that, I guess we'd just have to put you at school there at Red Elm, which is a considerable walk from where we live.
and I don't hold with idleness, Jamie. So there would be chores to do after school and on Saturdays. Now, we didn't come to agreement right off, but finally we did. I agreed to pay your grandpa $1 a month till your 12th birthday for your service. So if you come, we between us got to shoe 2 more horses a month or beat 4 more plowshares to make things come out. I guess we can do that. Now, you think on that while I get this team ready. It's a good long ride to Red Elm. Jamie didn't need to think. He knew what he wanted to do before Nate had told half his story about what had gone on at the Wilson farm. He looked at Nate. I want to go with you. Please take me with you. I thought you might, seeing what you told me, so I brought what they said was your things. Now you look at it carefully and you tell me if anything of yours is missing. If it is, I'll go right back in there and get it for you. There was something else. Jamie knew that the picture of his mother, which sat on the Wilson mantle, was rightly his, but he instantly resolved to not risk his new wonderful future by having Nate go back. No, sir, that's all. All right, Jamie Balfour, let's shake hands on it. You're a mite young for it, but not too young to learn that when you agree on something, you shake hands on it, and that's the way it is. You do it. And Jamie, don't forget, I said you'd have chores to do. Jamie agreed. Then he remembered the chores, and they shook hands. It was a long way to Red Elm. At first, Jamie reveled in every yard the journey put between himself and the Wilson farm. Nate told him things about Frank Balfour, things he'd never heard. How Frank had broken the meanest horse in Wilford County. How he'd made Fanny Stone a big skillet of plain metal to prove he was as good a smith as Nate Stone. How he was the first man in the county who knew how to graft pecan trees, and how no man was more generous to the widow and orphan than Frank Balfour. It was balm to Jamie's soul. But long before they turned into the lane of Stone Farm and its blacksmith shop, he was sound asleep. Jostling gently against the great mass of the blacksmith, he was only half awake when Nate led him to the lamp-lit kitchen door and told his wife, "Fanny, I brought home Jamie Balfour. He's Frank and Nora Balfour's boy. He is apprenticed to me now, and we need to feed him and put him to bed as soon as he does a chore for me." "Nate Stone, are you out of your mind? Look at all that blood on his clothes. You talk chores to somebody else. I'll take care of that boy." "You let him be, Fanny. Me and him has an agreement, solemn made, about this chore. Don't fret about the blood either. Tain't his." Nate shook the boy roughly awake. "Jamie, you remember that chore I told you had for you to do?" "Yes, sir." "Well, you take this bucket and you go to that door in the barn right there. That's the corn crib. Take this lantern with you and this bucket. Don't spill it now. You feed the critters in that corn crib, you hear? Every day." Jamie stumbled off toward the corn crib. Nate told Fanny they would go see about him after he unharnessed and fed the team. A half hour later, Nate and Fanny went to the crib and slowly opened the crib door. There was Jamie in the circle of lantern light with a squirming puppy clutched to his breast. Meg, the Stone's old dog, watched tolerantly as Jamie stroked its fur. 3 more very similar puppies were busy between Meg and Jamie, licking spilled milk off the crib floor. Nate closed the crib door quietly and told Fanny as they walked away, "I'll come get him in a little while. There are things a boy needs worse than he needs food and sleep. That's for certain sure." I realize that this story drips with sentiment, and it's not the type of thing which is in vogue today. But I had a reason for writing it. These are my father's words. The story up to a point is true. My father was Jamie. When my father was 6, his father disappeared on his way to the Panama Canal. The ship he was on burned and sank at sea. My father was put to live with his mother's parents, who also had a son, still remaining at home, who was 14. The gypsies were true, and they did give my father a dog, which my uncle shot at his father's bidding. From the point where Jamie meets Nate Stone, the whole remainder is fiction. Why didn't I tell the rest like it really was? How my dad dug a little grave in the cotton field, buried the dog, went back to the house on the hill and took his licking and lived under the Rupert's eye until he left home at 16 to go to Tennessee in 1 year of college because it was too drab, too pointless.
too devoid of hope, up to the point where Rupert shot the dog and all happened. I've met all these people. Grandpa and Grandma Wilson were much as I have shown them. Rupert grew up to become a crooked bail bondsman and lawyer in Dallas who preyed on the young women he got out of jail. Dad never forgot the bicycle. I had a bicycle all my life. Even though we had to tie it on the bumper of the Model A Ford we moved in, I always had a horse. And never one time in my life did I ever doubt that my parents loved me.
Its message to the world is simple, direct, significant far beyond the immediate surroundings.
I miss the smell of cow manure and fresh-cut hay or even lawn that mixes with my line-dried clothes and cleanses me of dumpster smells, sour liquored memories, barroom carpets soaked in piss with cigarettes that linger on the lips, indicting covert shades of manic nights spent speculating in the place where love is sold by orange neon glaring light that advertises incremental death served from a spout that calls in still small voices beckoning with siren song, false hopes made real in fleeting moments. Snapshots of the night before that ended in the cold despair of morning spent in silent shame. Unforgiving clocks that move too slow to cover my iniquities with grace of time, my fickle ally. The tractor on my father's farm provides a momentary comfort. Diesel smell and throaty rumble offer solace. Cover wounds all self-inflicted as I mow in straight lines. Geometric order out of chaos. With my father's periodic waving, coaxing in my struggles with the demons that have taken other loved ones in his family while he looked on, always coaxing, offering in loyalty all that he had to push the river back behind the levee crumbling all around his youngest son, who surfaces and then goes under. I can only smile and wave, and wish that I could find redemption from the galling black obsession driving me to find the secret why the grass, the sacrifice, in heat, oppressive, swirling, thick like Cairo syrup, hot like blood that's leached of poison, pure like nature. For a moment I'm suspended. Time is frozen. All the voices sudden silence. Harmony is on that tractor in the heat down by the river. With my father gently waving on that sea of grass, no drowning, no repulsive smells to haunt me. With the memories, my sins die. God is good, but I can't see him like I see my father waving from the porch with his forgiveness. Now I'm on the bus commuting with a book to serve as bandage on a wound like vivisection in my gut, but no one sees me. Hoping that next time the damage won't be so severe that mowing can't repair or stop the bleeding, or that line-dried clothes won't mask the smell of spirit putrefying, or walk into the river with my dogs as my companions substitutes my dad by proxy, worrying that they cannot perform the function God assigns them, looking at this erring child who coaxes them to deeper water, hoping that their God won't leave them drowning, while he seeks his answers in this stream so aptly named. This Rio de los Brazos de Dios. That'll do it for this week, folks. You know, the Lord wants you to support this ministry so that it can grow and reach more people. As the choir sings us out, please look for the donate button on your screen. Or if you're here in the congregation, if you'll crawl down the aisle with a $5 bill in your mouth, you'll receive a free autographed picture of our Lord. Amen and amen. Talk about the Mugtoe connection.